Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's an awkward flaw in the nation's missile defense program so far, says our guest tonight. Namely, it doesn't work. At least that's the argument that MIT professor Theodore Postol makes. The U.S. government isn't talking that way. In fact, it isn't talking much at all, taking the controversial project under wraps as it pours billions of dollars into the effort. In this hour, missile defense goes undercover in the next generation of Star Wars. We begin tonight in Pakistan, where officials announced today they have two Americans in custody who were captured more than a month ago. The Americans were caught trying to cross into Pakistan from Afghanistan. Pakistani officials say they believe there may be more Americans among their prisoners. I spoke earlier with Dexter Filkins, a reporter with the New York Times in Islamabad. I asked him if there's been word from the American government on these arrests.
The American government today confirmed that, in fact, there were two Americans who were arrested while they were trying to cross over from Afghanistan. They were taken into Pakistani custody. It was actually two separate incidents. What they're saying now, and again, this is very confusing, but what they're saying now is that one guy has been deported. He's gone back to the United States. He's not suspected of having any terrorist ties. There's another guy who's being held in Pakistani custody at the moment, is being questioned. Obviously, there must be a reason why they kept him longer than the other guy, but my understanding is that the Americans are satisfied that neither one of these guys are al-Qaeda. I don't think this is the end of things, but I think there may be some more people out there and some other incidents, but that's where it stands right now.
Americans have been showered with news and speculation about Jose Padilla, also known as Abdullah Al-Muhajir, and John Walker Lind, of course. You're saying that the U.S. government is saying today that these Americans were not affiliated with al-Qaeda or the Taliban?
Yes, that's right. That's right. I mean, my understanding is that the two people who are confirmed today to have been taken into custody are Afghan Americans. You know, what they were doing crossing over on foot from Afghanistan to Pakistan is anybody's guess, but I don't know, maybe they had family out there or something. But at the moment, that's what they're saying. If I could just say, this has been a terribly confusing few days, and I wouldn't be surprised if we heard some more in the next few days.
We read in your story that the men have been held since early May. That's a long time to hold people if there was no reason to.
That's one of the things here that hasn't been worked out yet. One of the guys, I think, he's confirmed to have been detained in early May, and the other one somewhat later in May. It's just unclear as to why here we are, middle, late June, that the world is just finding out why a couple of American citizens have been held this long without anybody knowing about it. And, you know, we're not getting answers.
And did you say that both men are Afghan Americans?
That's my understanding, yes, yes.
Can you describe for us, Dexter, the area of Pakistan in which the men were discovered?
Well, my understanding is that they crossed over from eastern Afghanistan into what's known as, it's part of the Northwest Frontier Province. It's the western border of Pakistan. But it's a special area, and it's one of the areas which are known here as the tribal areas, and these are extremely remote. I mean, I've driven through these, and it's really like you're on the moon, and the roads are awful, and there's often no electricity or no telephones. It doesn't look like it's rained in 1,000 years. And that's what it's like out there. And I have to say that this is the same area where the U.S. is convinced that there are a lot of al-Qaeda and Taliban where they fled to following their defeat in Afghanistan. And, in fact, there's a lot of American forces out there looking around, for anybody they can find.
We read, of course, from the Associated Press that FBI agents have or had already interrogated or questioned both of these men. Was that confirmed by the U.S. government today?
That's not confirmed. There's just a lot of things that aren't confirmed, including their names. I mean, nobody seems to know who they are, where they're from, what they were doing out there, who's spoken to them. I mean, I think you can assume that these guys have been interrogated. I can't imagine, just given the intensity of the American focus and operation out here, that somebody from the U.S. government didn't come and talk to these guys. Let me back up. I don't know about an American interrogation. My understanding is that they were visited by, embassy officials. I think any American who's detained abroad is typically entitled to a visit like that. whether it went beyond that and whether they were, you know, actually questioned, you know, fairly intensely is I just don't know.
Given the media attention that naturally gloms onto Americans found in the midst of this, Dexter, do you think U.S. authorities may be trying to keep these detentions quiet so that they have a chance to deal with individuals like this before they become a celebrated American Taliban?
Well, you know, that's the $64,000 question, and it's obviously not an accusation that anybody should make lightly. But you have to wonder when you hear 5 weeks after the fact that Americans have been held in custody by an American ally and have possibly been interrogated by American officials, you have to wonder what's going on.
Do you have the sense, Dexter, that the American players in this region are a significant piece of what's going on, or are these just marginal fellows who get attention because of the passport that they hold?
I think it's the latter. I mean, I with the exception of Padilla, I don't, you know, all the facts of that case and the whole story there aren't known yet. The American government seems to think he's a fairly significant guy. I happened to be in Mazar Sharif in northern Afghanistan when Walker came walking out of the prison and after the riot, and it was just this extraordinary scene. These are just, you know, kind of freebooters, and Walker looked like he was just, you know, a kind of a mixed up guy who got mixed up with the Taliban. I think these guys are pretty marginal, you know, at this point. There was another American in the same prison with Walker. Haven't heard as much about him. He was an Arab American born in Louisiana. All the circumstances are unclear, but with the possible exception of Padilla, it doesn't look like any of these guys were really big players.
Dexter Filkins, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Dexter Filkins is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke with us from Islamabad, Pakistan. During the Gulf War, the first President Bush lauded the Patriot missile as a great success in knocking down Iraqi Scuds. As it turned out, the Patriot did not perform as well as the government reported, and MIT professor Ted Postol was the one to blow the whistle. Today, Postol is taking on this Bush administration's high-priority missile project, the $200 billion Missile Defense Shield. An early test of the anti-missile system, described as an unqualified success, is dead wrong, he says. Fudged, manipulated, rigged. But it's getting harder to be a critic. The Pentagon is classifying details of the anti-missile intercept tests, hiding rather than confronting system failures, says Postol. Is this the beginning of another defense spending black hole, or do you still have faith that a Star Wars missile shield will work? How long are you willing to wait and pay for classified tests of a national missile defense? Should the nation's biggest public defense initiative be more open to the public? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Theodore Postol. He's professor of science, technology, and national security policy at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Good evening and welcome, Ted Postol.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
Thanks for being here. You have made yourself no great friend of the Pentagon lately and before, Ted Postol. The National Missile Defense Program has taken some pretty hot words from your pen recently. What is it about what's going on with the National Missile Defense Research and Development Program that has you steamed?
Well, I think the basic problem with the National Missile Defense is that it has no chance of working even when you look at the basic science, let alone the technology. The problem with the system is simply that it's trying to make intercepts in the near vacuum of space. And in the near vacuum of space, a feather and a rock will travel along together because there's no aerodynamic drag to cause the feather to slow up relative to the rock.
And the significance of that in missile defense?
Well, in missile defense, the significance is that you can build decoys that are simply of the shape of a warhead or have properties that look similar to the warhead. And even though these decoys are very light, they will just travel along in space along with warheads.
So you're saying it's not that we can't knock something out of space, but if an attacker, would put up a lot of decoys around a nuclear missile, let's say, we wouldn't know which one to hit?
That's exactly correct. There's never been an issue on my part with the possibility of hitting these objects. My concern has been from the beginning that it is extraordinarily easy to build decoys. Now, what advocates for missile defense are trying to claim is that somehow decoys are difficult to build. This is their argument.
That adversaries would not be capable of putting effective decoys in space.
Yeah, that's what someone like, for example, the program manager, Lieutenant General Ronald Kadish, tries to tell the public.
Your view?
Well, my view is almost, I would say it's based in logic. It's an if A, then B type of argument.
Okay, we're all ears.
Basically, what General Kadish wants the public to believe is there is an adversary out there. Let's not worry whether it's North Korea or Venezuela or Montevideo.
China, you name it.
Or, there's an adversary out there who has the extraordinary scientific and technical infrastructure to build intercontinental ballistic missiles, has a distinctly different scientific and technical infrastructure that allows them to build nuclear weapons, has the capability to package the nuclear weapon inside a package that will allow the nuclear weapon to survive atmospheric reentry into the atmosphere and detonate, but they don't have the ability to build a balloon similar to the kinds of things you see at a zoo, and say a Mylar balloon that's aluminized.
You're suggesting that if they put up a Mylar balloon or 100 Mylar balloons around the missile, that would be sufficient to throw off an American missile defense?
Yeah, basically what the system has to do is look with infrared eyes. The kill vehicle, this object that homes on and tries to hit the warhead, is basically a telescope. And it looks in the infrared, but you can think of it as being very similar to looking in the visible. And it opens its eyes maybe 60 seconds prior to its attempt to hit the warhead,
mm-hmm.
which means it's 600 or 700 kilometers
it's
away.
It's right on top of it.
Well, it's a long distance because the closing speeds
are
10 kilometers per second.
Okay.
So it sees just little points of light in front of it. And then it's going to try – it has to be able to select the warhead relative to a balloon. This is equivalent to looking at suitcases inside an airport and trying to decide based on the shape and the color of the surface of the suitcase, which suitcase is a bomb in it.
So this sounds like reasonable grounds, at the least, for a pretty good debate. How's the debate going?
Well, I think what the Pentagon first did is they tried to mislead the press and the public by making claims that were clearly ridiculous. Let me give you an example. They claimed that now they look not only in the infrared but in the visible. That is to say, they not only look at
the objects. They can see if it's a balloon or a missile.
Well, they claim that they would be able to tell if it's a balloon or a missile. But this is the equivalent of looking at the suitcase with a pair of binoculars and then a microscope. It doesn't really matter that you're looking at the surface of the suitcase with a microscope or looking at it with binoculars.
Even if you can see it, you won't know which thing contains the bomb.
You don't know what's inside the suitcase. And since you don't have the ability to use an X-ray machine to X-ray what's inside the suitcase, you're limited to either infrared or visible, basically your eyes, you will never know what's inside the suitcase.
You've written that the Pentagon is not, in fact, really striding openly into a debate about this, but is rather dragging the whole project into a classified territory where it can't be debated.
Well, in fact, we have found that the Pentagon has sought to hide problems that they found early. So, for example, in the first flight test, which was not designed to hit anything, but simply to look at lots of different mock warhead and other objects that could be called decoys, they had a sensor that failed to work. And yet they were claiming to the Congress and other organizations that the success of the test was beyond their expectations. And we also know that the nature of some of the objects that they flew in that test and a follow-on test were such that the objects would be very hard to tell from a warhead. And we know that after those two tests, which was simply to look at these objects in space, what happened is they removed all of the objects that were most difficult to tell from warheads from all subsequent flight tests.
They made it easy. We're talking tonight about the untold story of the American Missile Defense Research and Development Program. You can join the conversation. How much should Americans know about the development of their own missile defense system? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the untold story of America's National Missile Defense System, the research and development that's going on in that quarter. And we're asking, how much should Americans know about the development of their own missile defense system? Does too much public information threaten U.S. security? And I guess if Americans are being asked to buy a vast system sight unseen, a $200 billion pick and a poke, you can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest is Theodore Postol. He's professor of science, technology, and national security policy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Ted Postol, what, in your view, is driving this ongoing, sort of unending determination to do this, even when evidence arises that it may be difficult or extraordinarily expensive or even impossible? What's pushing this?
Well, I think there are many political failures involved that explain at least part of this. First of all, the Clinton administration, rather than carrying on what I would argue would be a responsible debate on the subject, allowed itself to be pushed into doing things by extreme elements in the Republican Party. So Clinton, rather than say, look, you want to build a missile defense to these extreme elements in the Republican Party, we don't know what science can be used to successfully do this. Explain it to us, and let's have a real debate about this. What he basically did is he said, well, we'll build a little bit of a missile defense and we'll look at it and we'll think about whether or not we'll take the next steps in a little while. So he kind of legitimatized this activity as if there was some merit in it.
Bill Clinton was not going to be seen to be anti-defense.
Right. And so you have at the extreme a small number, I don't believe it's a very large number, of extreme people in the Congress and supporters of them, who believe honestly but wrongly that that you can build a missile defense. It's just a matter of spending enough money. I've even talked to some of these people, and I've explained to them the science, and they look at me and they say they have no answer, and they say, "Well, can we spend more money on it?"
But you know, we put a man on the moon. America knows and believes in itself; it can do extraordinary things. And you've got to admit, it sounds great to be protected from missiles raining down with nuclear weapons on them.
Well, if you could do it, I would be absolutely for it. In fact, my joke with my colleagues, which is not really a joke, is I always like to say, I like weapons that work. I think the most dangerous thing you can do is build a weapon system at vast cost that has no chance of working, thereby taking resources that could otherwise be used on other weapons programs, and also fooling people into thinking that they might be defended when they're not. That's a very dangerous thing to do.
But at this point, it's got a big head of steam on it, $70 billion earmarked for the next phase and $200 billion in total. What has the Bush administration or the Pentagon's response been to you when you've raised these flags and said, hey, watch out, we're on the wrong track here?
Well, basically, what the Pentagon has tried to do is make false arguments that somehow I'm violating security policy. And they've done things like send one day they sent three Defense Security Service agents show up at my office and pull me into an open conference room and try to deliver a letter to me that's stamped secret. And I looked at this thing and I said, I'm not going to read it. And they said, well, you have to. And I said, well, my agreement with the government is that I protect classified information. Mm. It doesn't obligate me to read classified information. And it was clearly an attempt to intimidate me.
You mean once you had read something stamped classified, you wouldn't be able to talk about it in public anymore?
Yeah, we now know from congressional testimony that basically what they were saying in this letter was that they regard the materials that I've been using as classified, even though these materials were derived from open sources. And thereby they were trying to create a situation where they could claim that I was informed in a classified letter that this material was classified and try to make some phony argument that I couldn't talk anymore.
Professor Postol, maybe maybe you shouldn't be talking about this. Maybe if Americans talk about the vulnerabilities of the missile defense shield, it just lays out for adversaries how to overcome it.
Well, I think if we were talking about extraordinarily esoteric scientific details that might make a difference, there could be an argument on that point. But we're talking about physics that's so fundamental, that's so basic. It's the equivalent of a competent engineer knowing clearly that a bridge is going to fall down and other people telling individuals that they can walk across the bridge and then saying, you can't talk about this because it's somehow going to damage our reputation.
Don't tell them that it's going to fall down.
That it's going to fall down. So there's a big ethical question here.
Ted Postol, stand by. I want to bring into our conversation Philip Coyle. He's senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. Philip Coyle was assistant secretary of defense and director of operational testing and evaluation at the Pentagon from 1994 to 2001. Good evening and welcome, Philip Coyle.
Happy to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. Philip Coyle, a very simple question. First, tell us exactly what was your role in the Pentagon as Director of Operational Testing and Evaluation?
My job was to make sure that military equipment was adequately tested and to report on the test results to the Congress and to the Secretary of Defense.
So that sounds like a job right at the heart of the subject and debate we're talking about tonight.
It is.
Ted Postol has been sharing with us his concern that more and more of this project is being pulled into classified territory. You've written about this as well. What's going on with the openness or lack of openness around the National Missile Defense Project?
Well, on the face of it, the Pentagon could argue just what you said a minute ago, namely that we don't want our enemies to know that our systems don't work or what their vulnerabilities are. But the program just is not at the point where we would be revealing any kind of information that would help an enemy. As Dr. Postol has pointed out, it's still too early for that. We're just in the very beginning stages of the research.
So why do you think the Pentagon is classifying more information about missile defense?
Well, I don't know, and I think it could be quite counterproductive, because it's clearly backfiring in the Congress. They've already complained about this. And if there isn't any information forthcoming, the Congress may decide not to fund this work.
What kind of information is the Pentagon looking to classify? I guess from an operations standpoint, what are the dangers of overclassifying information?
Well, so far they've decided to classify details of the targets and countermeasures to be used in flight intercept tests of the so-called ground-based mid-course system, the system that the Clinton administration pursued.
Mm-hmm. When you just a reality check here for a moment, Ted Postol is very forthright in saying he would support this, but it just won't work. Not now, not ever, the way it's currently conceived. And I guess it's difficult to conceive of a way to get around, in his mind, decoys. You've looked a lot at tests and test results. Are you equally confident that this simply can't be done?
I wouldn't say that it can't ever be done. But Pentagon briefings show plexiglass domes over the United States. And we're to imagine that enemy missiles bounce off that dome like hail off a windshield. And we definitely don't know how to do that. You know, perhaps someday with modern electronics and sensors and all, we can do more than we know how to do today. But we don't know how to build an impermeable shield.
It hasn't always been so wrapped in secrecy. I remember some years ago as a correspondent, I sat on Kwajalein Atoll in the middle of the Pacific waiting for an announced test for the missiles to come up and the missiles to come down. What's changed in the political or scientific environment that you, Philip Coyle, that you think has pushed the government toward this greater degree of secrecy?
I don't know of anything that's changed in either the political or the scientific environment. The politics are the same. There are people who are for missile defense and people who are against it. And the science, as Dr. Postol points out, is still at its early stages.
Philip Coyle, Ted Postol, stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Joe is on the line. Welcome, Joe. You're on the air.
Hello. I like the show. I'm working for one of these defense contractors that are building pieces of this radar. I'm not their spokesman, so I don't really want to say which one.
That's great. How's it working, Joe?
From my point of view, it seems to be working fine. I'm concerned about the caller. He seems to be not the caller, your guest.
Ted Postal.
Ignoring the ground-based radars. They're in the process of upgrading some of these, GBRP, UEWR, these things. And they're really, they're supposed to be providing information mid-flight mm-hmm. to the exo-atmospheric kill vehicle
mm-hmm.
to identify these decoys, particularly because they, from what I understand of them, they're going to be deploying from either the RV or the post-boost vehicle,
mm-hmm.
probably in a fairly erratic manner because they're going to be inflating and all sorts of things, and they aren't going to have the same kind of precession and tumble that a typical RV would have, and therefore they'd be distinctive.
So, Joe, in your experience, in your work, you believe that ground-based radar can help the kill vehicle, as you call it, that's supposed to take down the threat in space, can in fact help it or lead it to discern between a decoy and the real threat?
Absolutely. I mean, I completely agree with him that the kill vehicle itself can't identify these things. But I think the way they've got the overall system designed, where these ground-based radars are providing additional information, I don't see any reason it can't work.
Ted Postal, don't take us so far into the science that we can't follow, but let's hear a conversation between you and Joe.
Sure. I think that there are several distinct problems with the system if you have certain kinds of countermeasures. Let me give you an example. Imagine I had several objects separated by hundreds of meters apart, and they were observed by the radar, and the radar could, in fact, tell the warhead from the decoy. If there are many trajectories when you look at the system where the radar would not be able to observe the objects continually, and, in fact, the tracks would not be accurately measured so that when the kill vehicle encountered the objects, they would be mixed up relative to what the radar saw. So then the kill vehicle would have to select the warhead without any help from the radar. And in fact, if you look at the requirements on the kill vehicle, the military requirement meaning what the kill vehicle must do, the official requirement is that the kill vehicle must be able to discriminate without any information from the radar. So this particular thing of just closely spacing objects would defeat the system right there.
So you're saying, but why shouldn't it use radar? I mean,
it should use radar. And these radars, I agree with the caller that the radars are superb pieces of instrumentation. In fact, the radars work at almost the theoretical limits of what you would expect are possible, which is almost never the case with engineering. You almost never mm-hmm. do nearly as well as theory.
And they're close to it.
And they're very close to it. However, the radars can be defeated by simple means as well. For example, you can put reflectors on objects to make it look like these objects are different from what they are, because the radar doesn't get an image of the object. It gets a series of reflections. If you're looking at motions of a warhead, you can balance the warhead for purposes of the audio for our, mm-hmm. Our phone caller. You match what's called the ratio of the moments of inertia. I'm sorry to...
I'm sure Joe knows about that. But, Joe, let me bring you back in here. Ted Postal says there may be moments in the trajectory of the attacking vehicles in space or their decoys where they're not fully visible, if I understand correctly. Yeah. And in any case, the Pentagon is asking for something that works independent of radar, perhaps, should it fail, I guess.
Right. I don't actually have access to the requirements of the kill vehicle.
Send me an email. I'll send them to you.
But I wouldn't doubt that they'd want it to work independently. I'm sure they'd like every piece to work independently, but everything works better when it's working as a system. And you're absolutely right. There are certain trajectories for each radar that the objects are going to obscure each other. And using multiple radars, we do have a lot of overlapping coverage that, you eliminate a lot of these holes.
Joe, would you bet your life on it? Would you bet your city's life on it?
I don't think it'll work 100%, but if we're just going to get nuked anyway, I'd rather have, you know, even a 50% chance.
A shot at it. Joe, thank you very much for an illuminating call. Thanks for calling in. Philip Coyle, what do you hear in this exchange? I guess Joe says it's not an open and shut case here. He's working in the industry, and he's more than hopeful that it will work or work a lot of the time.
Well, Joe is correct, as Dr. Postol confirms. These high-power radars, so-called X-band radars, have been one of the great successes in the missile defense effort. General Kadish, who runs the Missile Defense Agency, has said many times, starting a couple of years ago, that building these radars was the long pole in the tent, as he put it,
mm-hmm.
meaning that if he didn't get those radars, the whole system would be delayed. Ironically, the Bush administration has not requested money for an X-band radar at Shemya at the end of the Aleutian chain
mm-hmm.
to be part of the system up in Alaska, and I don't understand why.
Curiouser and curiouser. Carla is on the line. Welcome, Carla. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that there is a good reason why that system isn't at the end of the Aleutians. This isn't about missile defense. It's about missile offense. Of course, the defensive capabilities could be easily overwhelmed. However, just pause for a moment and think about the possibility of thousands of weapons in space that could be targeted to anyone we think at the moment is our enemy on this planet.
Do you see that buried somewhere in the missile defense program?
I certainly do. I certainly do, and it scares the devil out of me. I think we're building the most dangerous, offensive system known to humankind where we can just sit back in some control room and play like this is a big video game. You know, imagine if Russia had that capability and we didn't about 50 years ago.
We would not have been too comfortable.
We would have been scared to death.
Carla, thank you for your call. We just have a minute before the break. Ted Postol, Carla sees a veiled offense in the missile defense. Do you buy that?
Well, I don't quite see it the way that Carla sees it. I do think that there is a serious problem with these missile defense systems being used for anti-satellite systems. In fact, they have almost no missile defense capability, but they can be used to shoot down satellites, and I think it will
take out other countries or adversaries' satellite communications, et cetera.
Right, and I think the Chinese have expressed very strong statements of concern about this.
Ted Post, I've got to ask you, we've just got 30 seconds before the break, but beyond the technical objections, I'm just curious, given the debate we heard with Joe, do you have a philosophical objection of some or any kind to space defense?
No, I have a philosophical disagreement with the argument that we don't know how to do this, so let's go ahead and bet our national security on it. That's my philosophical concern.
Well, that's a simple, straightforward concern, and we're listening tonight. We're talking about the untold story of America's National Missile Defense Research and Development Project. What do you think? How much should Americans know about the development of their own missile defense system? Can America make missile defense Star Wars work? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a $200 billion American missile defense project being dragged into the classified zone and whether that's the right thing, whether it can work. What do you think? Is the Bush administration taking classification of scientific research too far? Do you trust the Defense Department and its contractors to do honest research and testing unobserved? And I guess, is this critical piece of America's defense, is it a critical piece, or is it a kind of new Maginot line avoidable by any terrorist bomber with a suitcase? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Theodore Postol. He's professor of science, technology, and national security policy at MIT. And by Philip Cole, senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. We're joined now by Andrew on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Thank you. One critical point about the Maginot line was that it actually worked. Its fatal flaw was that it wasn't long enough. The Wehrmacht forces just came right through the Ardennes forest where the Maginot Line wasn't.
So that's a relative use of the term worked.
Right. It sort of worked. It just wasn't big enough. But that may be one of the fatal flaws of a missile defense shield is we perhaps could build one, but if it's not big enough to cover all the areas that are vulnerable, it's the Maginot Line all again. I worked for Raytheon in the mid-80s when the Patriot system was being developed. And just as one point of order about the Patriot system was that its original design was not meant to shoot down missiles or Scuds. And
right.
As a matter of fact, the Scuds as they were used in Iraq weren't even developed by then.
Mm-hmm.
It was originally designed in the mid-70s, in the early and mid-70s, as an anti-aircraft system.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, and then
so you're saying it was ready to do its job, but not to take down Scuds.
That its original design was that, but it was adapted in the mid-80s to perhaps shoot down missiles because they looked at it and said, all we have to do is change the software and throw in a couple more radars, and we can make this thing shoot down missiles.
But we were told it was working in bringing down the Scuds, and it later emerged, no small part due to Ted Postol's inquiry and writing, that it hadn't done that.
Well, I think it didn't do the job as well as they had thought it had. I think they were part of which they were taking credit for Scuds that had fallen off in the desert and failed on their own accord rather than being shot down. It didn't work 100%, but it didn't work 0% either. There were some confirmed kills.
There were no confirmed kills. There's effectively all the data that we've been able to obtain and all the data that was found when the House Government Operations Committee looked into the claims of the U.S. Army found that there was no evidence at all for any intercepts.
Andrew, if you'll forgive me, I don't want to get totally back into the Patriot, but what lessons do you pull from that whole experience into the missile defense era?
Well, it's possible to adapt things to different purposes. And another point of, shall we say, defense science was, I think there was a similar argument going on in Great Britain in the 30s. When they first started to invest heavily into radars, I mean, they were investing in a very large, very expensive, and in some people's view, with a very questionable science of radar. And as a matter of fact, there was one very critical component on that not even the Germans knew about, not even we knew about, that the Brits had in their hip pocket and gave to us around 1939, 1940, when the war really started to take off.
Fast forward to 2002. What does it mean for us today in this program?
We don't know everything. We don't know what the government has in its hip pocket, and sometimes it has to hold these secrets in order not to tell everybody what we've got on hand. And the device was called the Klystron tube, and it was the device that made radar possible. It gave you a beam of radio energy that could be directed at an aircraft, and then you could pick up the reflections.
Of course, so that was the miracle in the pocket. Andrew, you've got your observation, and I appreciate it. Ted Postol, how about this? I mean, as we move into a war on terror, we move deeper into a trust me era. Andrew points out that Britain had a kind of a miracle in its pocket. On the other hand, Adolf Hitler promised a Wunder in der Tasche, a miracle in the pocket. He didn't have it when the end of the war came. But still, Andrew says, don't be so certain. There may be elements here that we just don't know about, that the government knows about. This is your life and career. But to a lay person, in a time of war, when the government says, trust us, and we're on our way here, we're taking money from our citizens in enormous quantity and investing it here, there's a desire to believe that something worthwhile is going on.
Well, when you talk about radar, for example, you know that a radio signal will reflect off the surface of an airplane, and that you may or may not be able to measure the reflection depending on technology available to you. There's no question about the physics of it. There may be issues of the technology available to you. For example, do you have a Klystron that is it actually doesn't direct the radar beam. What it does is it generates high-powered radio signal that is then directed by an antenna. And so you could have arguments about whether technology is available that does the job. But you're not asking physics to be different from what we know the physical world to be. In the case of the missile defense program, we're asking a system to be able to look with eyes and tell what's inside an object based on the surface properties of the object. And that's just not going to be doable.
Dick is on the line calling. Welcome, Dick. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for Dr. Postol.
Mm-hmm.
And it follows up a little bit from his comments just now. If the engineering is so fundamentally flawed, almost to the point of violating law of physics, as he seems to be contending, what is the motivation for the DOD and the subcontractors, whether they're, I don't know who's bidding this, General Dynamics, Raytheon, or whatever, they're staffed with engineers. Don't they see this as well, or are there large-scale ethical problems here that, to the extent they'll do anything to win a proposal and make money? This is what I don't understand. What is the incentive for people to do something that you feel is so fundamentally flawed from the outset that everyone should see it?
Thanks for your question, Dick. Ted Postol.
Well, I think what happens is people do the best they can, and what happens is some people know exactly what's going on. For example, I believe General Kadish knows what's going on. He's made comments on the fly that indicate to me he understands that there's a problem with the system. And other people just try to do the best they can, given that they're doing their job. In addition, if the Congress doesn't impose leadership, then why should you expect the contractors to say, we're not going to take the hundreds of billions of dollars you're going to dump on us? So I think it's not that people are all crooks. It's that people have different incentives depending on where they are in the structure.
And they'll go out and give it a shot. Eric is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Last minute. I just wanted to observe one of the things that really concerns me is the security classification of all this material. And I think it was Edward Teller who observed at one point that when you classify material, you're actually doing more harm to yourself than anyone else because, you know, spies, agents are going to find a way to get secrets. But if you leave things unclassified so that civilian researchers can take a crack at it, you actually end up getting a lot further ahead in technological development than you do if you just keep it restricted to a very small group of people. And
we got your point, Eric, and it takes it to a really tough nub here. Philip Coyle, are we headed deeper into classified territory on the missile defense front, and what do you think that will mean for work and for progress and for honesty on this project?
Well, it depends on how far they decide to go with this. If, for example, they classify the descriptions of the flight tests generally, if they classify the information they prepare on the budget requests for Congress, if they classify the same kind of information for all the missile defense programs, air, land, sea, and space, I think it will make it nearly impossible for the Congress, the press, and the American people to know what's really going on. And I think it'll also make it very difficult for even the Secretary of Defense to know what's going on because he doesn't have the time to go to classified briefings all the time. He gets a lot of his information from the so-called early bird, the compilation of press articles. Mm.
Ted Postol, we've just got 30 seconds left. Do you think this train is going to be slowed down or stopped?
I don't know. But I can tell you that the Secretary of Defense believed that the Patriot worked in the Gulf War. He was misinformed by his own people. Perhaps not intentionally, but that was that's what happened. So if you don't have openness and checks and balances, you're going to have some big disasters.
And we see less openness looming. Ted Postol, thanks so much for coming in tonight.
Thank you very much.
Theodore Postol is professor of science, technology, and national security policy at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Philip Coyle, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Philip Coyle is senior advisor to the Center for Defense Information. He was assistant secretary of defense and director of operational testing and evaluation at the Pentagon from 94 to 2001. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, transmissions from beyond the solar system. This is On Point. Thunderstorms in Florida have once again delayed the return flight of two astronauts who have spent a U.S. record 196 days in space. But Daniel Bursch and Carl Waltz have nothing on the true iron horse of the space program, the Pioneer 10 spacecraft.
So we're in the mission control area for Pioneer 10. Now, right now, they're preparing to send quite a few commands up to the spacecraft so that we can look on Jupiter. The interesting feature here is that the a round-trip light time, the time to get a message from here up to the spacecraft, and then to get a return answer is an hour and a half.
That was a NASA launch manager describing Pioneer 10's close encounter with Jupiter in 1973. It was 19 years ago this month that the little spacecraft with the huge antenna became the first man-made object ever to leave the solar system. And much to everyone's surprise, it's still talking today. Sure enough, the last time NASA tried to contact the old bucket of bolts earlier this year, it dutifully responded, albeit 22 hours later. After all, Pioneer 10 is more than 7 billion miles away. Even Dr. Larry Lasher, who oversees the Pioneer 10 mission for NASA, is amazed that the ship just keeps on plugging.
Miraculously, we're still in contact with Pioneer 10. It's still sending back data. We never, in our wildest dreams, thought we would be. But here we are, 30 years after launch, still getting back signals. An interesting sidelight is we're kind of proud of the having still getting this information, but also the fact that the scientist who's analyzing this data is 88-year-old Dr. James Van Allen, who is the discoverer of the Van Allen radiation belts, because he's interested in finding this edge of the interstellar space. We're powering it with this radioisotope thermoelectric generator, and so that is working for 30 years, and it's kind of even amazed the manufacturer of it that, wow. So I was asked in a presentation I made how long, actually it was the 25th anniversary of launch, so question came, how long do you expect to hear from it? And I said, well, if we could listen for another year, that would be great and outstanding if we listened for two more years. So now here it is 5 years later, and it's still coming in, so it keeps on ticking. One of the engineers that was working on Pioneer 10 said, why don't we put our stamp on this mission by having a plaque which we could send out, and, you know, who knows whether some sentient being someday would ever discover it. Carl Sagan liked that idea.
But in the remote contingency that there are interstellar spacefaring societies which might someday pick up this derelict no longer radioing, we thought we would put a message on it to indicate a little bit of where we are, when we are, and who we are.
Carl Sagan collaborated with Frank Drake, who is very famous in his own field of looking for extraterrestrial intelligence. First, they put a schematic of the spacecraft, and then standing next to that were two figures that's supposed to represent humans. And then they had a schematic of the solar system, and the digit one was indicated by a picture of a hydrogen atom. We scientists are always interested in is trying to understand where we all started from, you know, where we all came from, where did the universe come from. One of our goals is to try to find out what's the possibility of life forming. Frank Drake, he actually came up with what's called the Drake equation, and he went through a series of about five or six different factors there and came up with the conclusion that there must be life out there. Now, as far as finding this plaque, that's another story. The Pioneer mission, I'm just in awe of it. All the people around the world that are so intent on following it. I have a website, and after 30 years, it still gets close to 1,000 hits a day, if you can believe that, but people still are interested in it. I think it's just a tremendous testament to how we on Earth here can build something that is so durable and has done such an amazing job.
Dr. Larry Lasher is project manager for Pioneer 10. He spoke with us from his office in Moffett Field, California. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Darren Manoogian and Michael Garth, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.